This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 24th of January, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Congress begins to examine poverty, at least one of the issues missing from Bush's State of the Union address. An Air Force Reserve officer sues her employer, claiming she was fired because she was deployed to Iraq.
I gave him orders on a Tuesday, and 2 days later he told me that he had news for me that he was eliminating my position.
And we'll hear from Beirut, where fighting between opposition protesters and government backers could turn into civil war. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee today voted against President Bush's policy to increase troop levels in Iraq, saying that the plan is not in the national interest. The larger Senate body is due to debate the troop surge measure next week. The outcome of today's Senate panel vote is non-binding. In other military news, the National Security Council of the Czech Republic today decided to give the go-ahead to talks with the United States over the installation of a global missile defense system in Czech territory. If the project wins approval from the president and both houses of the Czech parliament, the base would be the first missile defense site located outside of the U.S. Russia has publicly opposed the plan. This news from Somalia. U.S. officials today confirmed a second airstrike in the East African country. Meanwhile, suspected Islamists launched several mortars at Mogadishu's international airport today, killing at least two people and wounding four others. Abdurrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
The attack came as passengers were boarding a domestic civilian airplane and as a delegation from the Norwegian embassy in Kenya arrived in the Mogadishu airport. Bystanders rushed the wounded to the hospital for treatment. The dead and the wounded were civilians seeing off their relatives at the airport at the time. Among the wounded is a 10-year-old boy. The attack comes one day after Ethiopian soldiers began withdrawing from Somalia. Gunmen rarely launched their attacks on the Ethiopian and Somali troops during daylight hours. Ethiopian and Somali troops guard government buildings in the capital, including the international airport, the seaport, and the presidential palace compound, which was attacked last week as the president and the prime minister were holding talks with clan elders. The ousted Islamists who ruled much of southern Somalia vowed to wage a guerrilla war against the Ethiopian troops, who helped the transitional federal government drive them out of the country. For FSRN, I'm Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
A new low-power FM station went on the air today in Nairobi, Kenya, despite an armed robbery prior to its launch. WORT's Norman Stockwell has the story.
So can you please give us your understanding of the World Social Forum?
It's just a platform to enable people to discuss the social ideas and just social themes that affect them in their different regions.
Radio Huru, which means free radio in Swahili, is the independent station of the World Social Forum. Radio Huru began its first broadcast today at 10:30 a.m. local time. The station, built by local young people working together with indie media activists and the U.S.-based Prometheus Radio Project, broadcasts a mix of African music and interviews with World Social Forum participants. The launch of this collaborative project was slowed but not stopped when the station was raided Monday evening by three armed men who stole CD players and a laptop but left the more valuable tools and broadcast equipment. With about 25 watts of power, the station's signal now reaches throughout the territory covered by the World Social Forum activities here in Nairobi, Kenya. The forum wraps up tomorrow, but local activists are already planning a permanent home for the newly constructed transmitter. Reporting for FSRN, this is Norman Stockwell in the Kasarani International Sports Stadium, just outside Nairobi, Kenya.
Back in the U.S., a week-long series of immigration raids in the Los Angeles metropolitan area has resulted in the arrest of over 760 people. Of that number, more than 450 have already been deported. The Department of Homeland Security says it targeted immigrants who had criminal records or who had defied deportation orders. Part of an operation known as Return to Sender, the raids are some of the largest in U.S. history. The Defense Department has given the Navy permission to keep training with sonar for another 2 years, a move denounced by environmentalists who say the sound waves harm marine mammals. WMNF's Mitch Perry has more.
Navy officials had sought the 2-year exemption from the Marine Mammal Protection Act, saying they needed time to study how sonar use at major underwater training ranges affects the environment. Sailors use active sonar by pumping sound waves through the ocean and listening to the echo as it bounces off underwater objects. Navy leaders have made practicing sonar techniques a top priority, as other countries have bought more advanced diesel submarines, which are quieter than earlier models and thus harder to find. But environmentalists cite incidents of whales, porpoises, and dolphins that have become stranded on beaches after being exposed to sonar. An attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council said he would continue to press the lawsuit in federal court in Los Angeles, invoking other federal laws to force the Navy to reduce sonar power at night when whales are harder to see and to avoid coastal waters and other areas where whales and dolphins congregate. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed a resolution on Capitol Hill today that would put lawmakers on record on their stance of the president's troop increase. The vote was along party lines, with the exception of Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, the only Republican to vote in favor. The legislation could come up on the Senate floor this week. It could also be combined with a resolution written by the senior Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia, which also expresses opposition to the president's plan. The committee debate on Iraq began just 12 hours after the president gave his seventh State of the Union address. In that address, Bush tried yet again to convince the public that his plan for Iraq will work. He said he decided to send additional troops because Iraqis are not yet ready to secure the country on their own. Bush has now brought the argument on Iraq full circle. Instead of suggesting that the perpetrators of 9/11 had links to Iraq, he said allowing Iraq to deteriorate into chaos could cause another event like 9/11.
And out of chaos in Iraq would emerge an emboldened enemy with new safe havens, new recruits, new resources, and an even greater determination to harm America. To allow this to happen would be to ignore the lessons of September the 11th and invite tragedy. Ladies and gentlemen, nothing is more important at this moment in our history than for America to succeed in the Middle East, to succeed in Iraq, and to spare the American people from this danger.
Acknowledging that the war on terror will be long-lived, Bush asked for the recruitment and training of more than 90,000 troops and the creation of a civilian reserve corps. It would consist of citizen volunteers that could be called for deployment. President Bush then urged the Democratic-controlled Congress to unite behind his plan.
Our country is pursuing a new strategy in Iraq, and I ask you to give it a chance to work.
Besides Iraq and the war on terror, the president talked about domestic issues, health care, energy, and education. But one thing that was missing in the president's State of the Union was poverty. Bush did not mention the Katrina disaster or the growing number of unemployed African American men, just two of the examples that highlight poverty in the United States. As Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports, Congress has begun to examine that issue.
In his State of the Union, the president focused very little on poverty. He said lifting trade barriers would help poverty in Africa, and he gave examples of people who have overcome hardships to become successful in the United States. He briefly spoke about one effect of poverty, poor education. He encouraged Congress to renew his education initiative, No Child Left Behind.
We can make sure our children are prepared for the jobs of the future and our country is more competitive.
No Child Left Behind could see fierce debate in Congress. Democrats say the federally mandated program has been underfunded, depleting its potential. Chair of the House Democratic Caucus, Rahm Emanuel.
On education, hopefully he will come to the level of funding Leave No Child Behind.
As for a direct acknowledgement of the more than 13% of Americans who live in poverty, the president didn't have any. And he did not mention Hurricane Katrina, which brought the plight of the poor to the surface. That region is still trying to rebuild a year and a half later. But Congress has pledged to address poverty. In his first hearing as chair of the powerful Ways and Means Committee, Representative Charles Rangel did just that.
It is unfortunate that poor people don't carry the type of stigma of emergency and national security and those things. And Katrina is a classic example how that can happen. But we are now dealing with this from an economic viewpoint, a national security viewpoint, and certainly we are concerned that poverty and its continuation could have a negative impact on the strong economic growth we will need if we're going to try ever to get our great nation out of debt.
The hearing examined poverty's economic impact and ways in which it can be reduced. Georgetown University professor Dr. Harry Holzer testified before the committee.
We're really saying it's also an economic issue. It impacts on the economic health of the country, and therefore it's a sensible thing, not just a moral thing, but a sensible thing for the country to make significant investments to try to bring that poverty rate down.
A nonpartisan government-issued report released Wednesday said those who live in poverty are more likely to have health problems or become part of the criminal justice system, both outcomes that have negative impacts on the economy, the report said. Chairman Rangel, a high school dropout who later returned to school because of the GI Bill, vowed to address the issues of the poor. When FSRN asked if it concerned him that the president did not address poverty in his State of the Union, he said,
"President's influence has significantly been reduced."
In their first 100 hours agenda, the House of Representatives increased the minimum wage to $7.25 per hour, a mechanism they say will help the working poor. The Senate is currently debating the same bill, the final structure of which is still being determined. It will likely be paired, though, with $8 billion in small business tax breaks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Israel's President Moshe Katsav says he plans to temporarily remove himself from power following the decision to indict him on a series of charges, including rape, sexual harassment, and fraud. However, he needs parliamentary approval for a temporary suspension, and it's not clear that he'll get it, since so many lawmakers want him to resign. The charges against Katsav are the most serious ever faced by an Israeli head of state. Iris Makler reports from Jerusalem.
For the past 24 hours, the Israeli media and public have been focused on nothing else but the charges to be laid against their president, Moshe Katsav. It's partly due to the unprecedented severity of these charges, which include fraud, rape, and sexual harassment of four women who worked for Katsav in the president's office and also earlier when he was a cabinet minister. And the interest has been compounded by Katsav's denial of the charges and his refusal, so far, to resign. After 6 months of silence, Katsav held a long emotional press conference at his Jerusalem residence tonight, with his wife and sons by his side. At times shouting and at other times giving in to tears, the president blamed a conspiracy between the media and the police for the terrible situation he finds himself in.
No man could survive this onslaught, and the only reason I have survived is that I know the truth and I won't give in to blackmail and lies.
Katsav said he'd fight on to clear his name. He complained that he's been tried and found guilty in what he described as a witch hunt and a media lynch. He blamed it on his enemies, including those who opposed him becoming president more than 6 years ago, and female employees who held grudges against him because he fired them. He says he'd refused to give jobs in the president's office to the three women who've made the most serious allegations against him.
They didn't complain of rape then, but when the police came to them, they saw their opportunity to take revenge on me, and they seized that opportunity.
The women haven't spoken publicly, but their attorney denies the president's allegations. The attorney says that the president's office has been attacking the women personally from the outset, making false claims, such as asserting that one of the women was a prostitute. Police and journalists who investigated these claims have not found any evidence to support them. Former High Court Judge Eliyahu Motza says this is the worst and most embarrassing case since the establishment of the State of Israel. He calls on Katsav to resign in order to spare the public.
We are caught up in an episode which is revolting, and the president should free us from having to deal with this day after day. He should think of the public and spare us.
After President Katsav's emotional speech, Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert stepped into the debate. He added his voice to those calling on Katsav to resign. Olmert says that Katsav cannot continue to fight for his innocence from within the presidential palace. Katsav refuses to resign until charges are laid, and has instead requested the parliament's permission to suspend himself from his duties temporarily. Parliament decides on this tomorrow, but it may reject the request due to the overwhelming support for the president's resignation. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
Hundreds were wounded and at least three killed as Lebanon was brought to a standstill yesterday as calls for a general strike turned violent when opposition protesters took to the streets, burning tires and blocking all major roads in and around Beirut. The nearly two-month-long Hezbollah-led protest escalated into a second phase in a bid to topple the current Western-backed government of Prime Minister Fouad Siniora. The current crisis has cost the Lebanese economy $70 million a day, and many fear that the country could be slipping into a civil war. Simba Russo has more from Beirut.
Debris and mountains of sand were cleared today after fighting broke out in response to a general strike which paralyzed daily life in Lebanon. Yesterday, Lebanese awakened to a black sky filled with thick smoke and images of their country being burned. Opposition groups made up of pro-Syrian Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement escalated their nearly two-month sit-in by burning tires and blocking all major roads and highways. Five flights were cleared to land, but all others were canceled due to roadblocks cutting off roads to Beirut's international airport and the highway to Damascus.
Without fear, without stress, in a peaceful country where people don't fight every day in politics, or even if they do, but it doesn't go on the streets, you know? And it doesn't affect your personal life and your business and your daily life and your routine and everything. Everything. I have a kid who goes to school. I don't have to worry every time he's going to go to school what is going to happen if the road is going to close. This is for me normally and peacefully. And where, of course, the economy will be better also for the country, for work. And this is when I say for the best. In fact, for the best is the minimum that we need, Yani, to live, you know? That's the minimum that we're asking for.
Rania was on a flight arriving from Madrid. She explains what she experienced while walking from the airport.
Out of the airport, you feel it was chaos completely. You cannot go, you cannot cross from the airport as soon as you get out from the other way. You have to go walking. You cannot, the cars cannot go into the airport. I was with my suitcase trying to cross from the airport to the other road, and you had like a lot of fires, and they did like this huge mountain of sand to make sure that cars cannot go in and out.
The majority of the members of the current government are part of the anti-Syrian March 14th alliance. The pro and anti-government groups are divided along religious lines, with Sunnis and Druze supporting the current government, and Shia, mainly Hezbollah, supporting the opposition group. The Christian community is split between the supporters of the Lebanese forces and supporters of the Free Patriotic Movement, led by former General Michel Aoun. The opposition group is seeking to create a national unity government in which it demands one-third of the cabinet seats, which would allow them veto power. They are also seeking to force early parliamentary elections in hopes of removing the current majority held by the March 14th alliance. Meanwhile, the March 14th alliance is seeking to hold early presidential elections to replace the current pro-Syrian president, Emil Lahoud. In Lebanon, the president is elected by the parliament, so the group with the majority in parliament when the election takes place is likely to determine the next president of Lebanon. Jean Ushueri is a local artist. She fears her country is slipping into a civil war due to ignorance and a lack of a unified voice.
I'm angry. I'm angry that the country's paralyzed. I'm angry that we're back to where we were during the civil war, that nobody's learned anything, that they're repeating the same thing over again.
Yesterday's images of rock-throwing crowds could further tarnish Lebanon's economy, which was on the rebound until the February 14, 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The general strike comes 2 days before Prime Minister Fouad Siniora is due to appear at a major international donors conference in Paris to secure much-needed aid for Lebanon. Mr. Siniora has proposed a reform plan which calls for a rise in the value-added tax and privatization of key utilities. The plan has met opposition and calls for a general strike by the Hezbollah-led opposition groups who maintain that this will put Lebanon's utilities in the hands of foreigners and worsen the country's $40 billion debt. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Simba Rousseau reporting from Lebanon.
With global attention intermittently centered on the crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan, the peace process in the south of Sudan is more often left out of the limelight. Members of Congress and the South Sudanese interim government gathered in Washington today to expand the focus to ensure that the peace process, which ended more than 20 years of civil war, doesn't fall apart. Darby Hickey reports from Capitol Hill.
Last week, the government of South Sudan opened its first diplomatic mission in Washington, D.C., and today ministers from the government created by the Sudan Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005, or CPA, were back in the nation's capital at a hearing today held by the House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Committee, Subcommittee on Africa. Chairman Donald Payne, New Jersey Democrat, described the scene in southern Sudan prior to the peace agreement as the first Darfur.
Innocent citizens were terrorized, killed, and maimed by aerial bombardments carried out by the government of Sudan. When oil was discovered in southern Sudan and the government began exploring the finds in 2000, the government used this newfound wealth to buy more Antonovs, more helicopter gunships, and more weapons of mass destruction to use against the people of the south.
The Comprehensive Peace Agreement was negotiated between the Sudanese People's Liberation Army and the National Congress Party-controlled central government. In the 2 years since it was signed, a number of key points of the agreement have not been implemented because of objections by that central government. Perhaps most significantly, the violence and genocide occurring in the western part of Sudan, the Darfur region, signals the true intentions of the central government, said former State Department Special Representative on Sudan, Roger Winter, who testified at the hearing today.
There's a fundamental flaw in the way the United States has been approaching Sudan over the last 2 years. That fundamental flaw is the belief inside our policy establishment that the National Islamic Front wants to be a responsible government. And we expect that a responsible government understand its obligation to care for and protect all the citizens of the country that government leads. It's my assertion that the National Islamic Front does not, in fact, want to be a responsible government.
The timeline of the CPA calls for clear delineation of boundaries between North and South Sudan, which could potentially affect control over the country's oil fields. Additionally, those demarcations would determine who will be eligible to vote in the upcoming elections and later a referendum on whether Southern Sudan will remain in the country or will secede. Luca Byangdeng, Minister for Presidential Affairs of the Government of Southern Sudan, said what he thought the vote would be if the referendum on secession were held today.
Consistently, we are seeing a pattern whereby if the people of Southern Sudan are to be asked today to vote, unanimously they will vote for separation for their own country. But I think this one should be understood in the wider context, because we have a certain block that we need to start investing in them now. Increasingly, I think our colleagues, the National Congress Party, is making the separation attractive to the people of Southern Sudan. Either they felt by signing the CPA, they have given away the South, so that in a way they are not investing so much in making unity attractive.
The hearing was peppered with terms that have become commonplace in contemporary U.S. foreign policy parlance: counterterrorism, strategic resources, oil, and more. As Roger Winter and Minister Deng both argued for a greater pressure to be put on the central government to follow the terms of the peace agreement, much was left unsaid. With hundreds of thousands dead in Darfur and the legacy of millions killed in southern Sudan, the consensus at the hearing was that something must be done. But suggestions for specific actions were not forthcoming from Republican or Democratic members of the subcommittee. Residents of southern Sudan are set to vote for or against secession in a referendum in 2011. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
An Air Force Reserve officer filed suit Tuesday in San Francisco, claiming her former employer violated federal law when it fired her after she returned from active duty service in Iraq. Max Pringle reports.
Lieutenant Colonel Deborah Mule spent several years as administrative director of the cardiac program for Sutter Pacific Health Center in San Francisco. Her suit alleges that her former employer, Sutter Health of California, terminated her position soon after she returned from deployment in Iraq in May. Her lawyers argue Sutter violated the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act and other laws. They are seeking reinstatement and unspecified damages. Lieutenant Colonel Mule says her rights as a reservist were violated.
I lost my job as a result of my deployment to Balad Air Base, Iraq. And that happened in January of 2006, and I came back in May of 2006. And my boss informed me that I gave him orders on a Tuesday, and 2 days later he told me that he had news for me that he was eliminating my position.
Calls to Sutter Health were not returned by airtime. Lieutenant Colonel Mule, who is attached to the 349th Medical Squadron at Travis Air Force Base, said her employer told her they were eliminating her $175,000 a year position because of economic cuts. Her attorneys say they are waiting for Sutter to respond to the lawsuit. David Lowe is an attorney at the law firm Rudy, Axelrod & Zief, which is representing Lieutenant Colonel Mule.
Their response we would expect in the next 45 days or so, next 30 to 45 days, and then, you know, we intend to move quickly to start developing the evidence in this case. So, you know, over the next, say, 2 to 4 months.
Mule, who has been decorated for her work as a combat surgeon, said she was never given any indication that her job would be eliminated before she deployed with her unit to Iraq. She said her treatment should be a cautionary tale to other reservists who leave when duty calls, only to find themselves unemployed when they return.
I really feel that I'd like to get the message out that this may be happening more than the public is aware, and that if someone with my years of military experience, if it can happen to me, it can happen to a young soldier or airman that is returning, you know, after an enlistment overseas.
David Lowe of Rudy, Axelrod & Zief says his client's case isn't isolated. He said he's aware of several other cases, but cautions that there isn't enough evidence to support the notion that employers are feeling more emboldened to terminate their reservist employees.
I'm not sure if we have enough information yet to say that it's a pattern either. Both Colonel Mule and I have independently heard stories from other returning service members who have found themselves in a similar situation where they have returned from a deployment and not had their jobs when they got back.
Sutter Health must respond to the lawsuit within the next few weeks. Lieutenant Colonel Mule's legal team say they're prepared to take the case to court if need be, but haven't ruled out an out-of-court settlement. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Taina Gysi and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can also send us your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.